we can also describe this combinatorially, and it is quite well known that the moments which you get in this limit can be described combinatorially in terms of non-crossing pairings for the Gaussian case, and more generally in terms of non-crossing partitions for the Wishart case. So you really can calculate these moments very nicely in combinatorial terms. And on the other hand, you can realize this limit distribution by very canonical operators on the full Fock space. So namely, the Gaussian random matrices in the limit are just given by creation plus annihilation operator. And for the Wishart case, you have to add some other kind of operator. And I will explain this a little bit more in detail. So this is just to get started. I will come back and show you a little bit more how these things work. But maybe let me now go on the general level to the questions about the fluctuation. So the question, the quantity in which I'm mainly interested in now is the fluctuations around this limit. So on the first level, you are looking on the limit of your random matrices. If n goes to infinity, you identify this limit, but then you can ask what are the fluctuations about this limit. And this is may mean that you should, for the random matrices, look on this quantity. So you don't take the expectation of one trace, but you take the expectation of a product of traces, and you can say you take the variance of this. So you subtract the expectation of the traces. Because in leading order, the expectation of a product just factorizes in the product of the expectations. But that's what we understand. So we subtract what we understand, and then we ask this difference, this fluctuation. Can we also describe this very nicely? And again, one knows something about this. Namely, essentially, one knows that there is a nice combinatorial description. So in the case of the Gaussian random matrices, this is given by non-crossing annular pairings. And I think Jamie talked about this yesterday, and in particular, this joint work with Andonica. In the Wishart case, which identifies very clearly this structure, this combinatorial structure which you have for describing these things. So these are the non-crossing annular permutations. Okay, so this gives a very nice description of these fluctuations in combinatorial terms. But the question is, are there any other descriptions? So can we also describe the limit of these fluctuations by operators? And maybe do we even have some kind of abstract concept behind this? Okay, and I want to convince you that indeed is the case. So we can replace this question mark by something. But let me start again first by the... Okay, now I want to become a bit more concrete, and let me start by the first level. So, and maybe I should start by really telling you what kind of random matrices I'm considering. So now I'm essentially restricting to the Gaussian case. So I'm looking on Gaussian random matrices. So they should be complex ones and Hermitian. So I have A of F. For each F, this should be a Gaussian random matrix. I'm not only considering one, but I consider a set of random matrices. So I really want to understand things from a non-commutative point of view, not just one random matrix, but a couple of them. And I'm indexing them. It's nice to index them by elements from a Hilbert space. If you don't like this, you can choose a basis for your Hilbert space, and then for a basis, you essentially get just independent random matrices. Okay, but maybe it's conceptually nicer to index your random matrices by elements, by vectors from a Hilbert space, a real Hilbert space. And what do you require? Yeah, so you require that the entries of your matrix form a Gaussian family with a prescribed variance. So this means for you only consider on one matrix, so this matrix should be self-adjoint, which means, of course, that the entries below the diagonal and above the diagonal are related with each other. But apart from this, they should be independent. That's what you usually call a Gaussian random matrix. They should be independent, and they should have a Gaussian distribution. So each of them should be normally distributed, and they should be independent. And if you have now more random matrices, then in addition, you also have to say what is the relation between the entries from one matrix with the entries of another matrix. And if you are choosing orthogonal F, then you are just saying these things are independent. But for general F, you can say that you have just a Gaussian family. So all your entries together form a Gaussian family, and you have a given covariance, which tells you something about the relation between these matrices. So if F and G are orthogonal, this just means that the entries from one matrix are independent from the entries of the other matrix. And if you have such random matrices, then it is well known that one can describe the expectation of normalized traces of products of these matrices. So understanding the limit distribution of these matrices means that you should understand the expectation of traces of products. So, and it turns out, I mean, what you should take, so trace, this trace here is the unnormalized trace, so it's 1 over n, it's a normalized trace, that's exactly the quantity which gives you something non-trivial in a limit. Oh, okay, so this limit exists if you take a product of your random matrices and you're looking at the expectation of this normalized trace. It turns out that you can calculate this limit very nicely in combinatorial terms, namely you just do it by taking a sum over special combinatorial objects, and each object and each non-crossing partition contributes in a very special way. Okay, so these are non-crossing pairings of n. So you have here a product of n terms, and this means you just have to pair up your n terms in a non-crossing way, and then each pairing contributes with a product where you just take the inner product of the apps which are paired together by the pairing. So the entries are Gaussian, which means there you have all pairings. But then, because of the structure of the matrix multiplication, the non-crossing ones, the crossing ones are in the limit suppressed. So they disappear in the limit. So it's the effect of the matrix multiplication that you.
But is there any explanation
why having matrices would have that figure? Yeah, you write down what the product means, and then you see that if you are calculating the traces, I mean that in special situations, you get better contributions in N than in other situations. And the good situations are those where the indices are paired in a very nice way, which corresponds to non-crossing. If we have crossings, then you don't have as many free indices as you would have in general. So you can exactly work it out what the contribution of a pairing is. So I think Jenny wrote it down yesterday. It depends on the fact that you have a matrix multiplication, which gives you a coupling of the indices, but that you also need, because the entries are Gaussian, you must pair them in the right way. Okay, anyhow, this is something which you have to observe. If you write it down, it's not so hard to see, but maybe you really have to write it down and see how it happens. Yeah, I only have given you an example what this formula means. So, for example, if you look on the product of four matrices, and you're calculating this expectation of the normalized trace, then the formula which I had before says the following. So now you should sum over non-crossing pairings of four elements, and there are exactly two of them, those two. And these are non-crossing ones. There's another pairing, but then a pairing where you pair one with three and two with four, but this is a crossing one. That's the one which is not there. Okay, so in the limit you only take the non-crossing ones corresponding to this one, and then you just take the inner product between the vectors which are paired together. Okay, so the first one, you pair F1 with F2, so you take the inner product between them and multiply it with the inner product between F3 and F4, and for the other one. There's a very simple structure in the limit, which is described in combinatorial terms by summing over non-crossing pairings. Probably what Jimmy did yesterday, showing this genus expansion. This is something which you observe if you just write down how you calculate these moments. If you have Gaussian random variables, then you have to sum over all pairings, and then it's more or less Wick's theorem. Okay, so you can say this is somehow a large n limit of Wick's theorem. Good, but that's a nice observation, but somehow the important point is that the structure which you see there also appears in a quite different context. Namely, you can also realize this moment by looking on the full Fock space. So there's a canonical. Okay, so let me just recall what I mean with the full Fock space. So you recall I have my random matrices which are indexed by a real vector space, by a real Hilbert space. I go over to the complexification of this, and over this I'm building the full Fock space. the full Fock space is just the direct sum of the tensor powers of this space. So this is just this one. And there are canonical operators, which I have in this context on the full Fock space, namely the creation and the annihilation operator. So L of F is the creation operator, which creates on the left just the function F, and the annihilation operator does the same on the other side. And that's something very canonical in this context. I mean, from an operator algebraic point of view, these are very canonical operators. Huh? So if you just consider them alone, this is, has something to do with the Kunz algebra, but we are more interested in von Neumann algebra, so we shouldn't leave them alone, but what we should consider is the sum. So indeed, what we should consider is that we take for each f the sum of L of f plus L star of f. And taking the algebra, the von Neumann algebra generated by them, which is the free group factor. So this is indeed a very, very nice operator algebra. And indeed, that's the point where Voiculescu came from in the very beginning. Good. Okay, but that's exactly the operators which give you somehow the same combinatorics as you get in the limit of random matrices. So namely, the theorem of Voiculescu on the relation between random matrices and free probability theorem can be stated in this context in the following way, so that we take these two quite different things, namely we take our random matrices, the Gaussian random matrices, on one side, and on the other side we take our operators on the full Fock space, our operators which are the sum of creation and annihilation operator. Right, each of them are just indexed by F. So, okay. But then the statement is that if I calculate very canonical quantities on both sides, then the limit of the random matrix side goes to the corresponding quantity on the full Fock space side. So I'm looking here exactly on the quantities in which I'm interested, on the expectation of the normalized trace for a product here, and in the limit n going to infinity, this is exactly by calculating the vacuum expectation of the product of the corresponding operators. I mean, omega is the vacuum vector in my Hilbert space, so this is the very canonical state which I have around in the full Fock space. It's a vacuum expectation state. And you see, I mean, I have here the product of my random matrices calculating this expectation of the normalized trace, and here I'm taking this the corresponding product of the corresponding operators. And you get the same quantity in the limit. And yeah, maybe just to make this clear, so maybe coming back to the example which I had before. So before I showed you how you calculate the limit for the product of four random matrices, so maybe we do the same now for the quantity on the full Fock space side. And if you just calculate this product of this expectation of this product of four, of course you can split it up like this, and then I mean you see this omega is the sum of the creation and the annihilation operator. If you are acting on a vacuum, you get zero, so this means if you annihilate something. So here you can only get F4, and the action of this one is either you create another F3 here, or you annihilate this one. And the same on this side. And if you just might work this out, what this is, you see that exactly you get the same contributions as before, namely a sum over two terms, which correspond exactly to the two non-crossing pairings which we had before. So you get exactly the same formula in the end as we had it before for the calculation of the random matrices. Okay, so that's somehow this relation. And of course we know somehow that in the background for this result we have this notion of freeness, because both realizations are realizations of free random variables. Somehow the explanation for this coincidence of two quantities, which we consider in very different contexts, is that indeed there is a common conceptual background. A common concept behind these two contexts. Huh? Okay, good. I mean, this is all known, but now, really, I want to go over to the fluctuations. So I know the limit, the large n limit, of the expectation of normalized traces, and now I'm asking about the fluctuation around this limit. So this means what I want to consider now, what I want to understand, are quantities like this, where I take the expectation, not of one trace, but of two traces. And I should subtract the leading term which I understand. Okay, so I take the expectation of the traces. In leading order, this factorizes, so I'm subtracting this term. And you see, I have now the unnormalized traces. Before I had 1 over n, huh? But because I'm subtracting this other term, it's exactly this quantity which goes now to something non-trivial in the limit n going to infinity. Okay, so I want to understand this, and I mean this is a quantity which is considered in the random matrix picture by quite a lot of people. I mean it's the next most interesting quantity. So you can say in the first step, I want to understand the limit. You can say this is, I want to see a law of a large number. I want to identify the limit. If I have understood the limit, I want to understand the fluctuations about this limit. And of course, always I have to adjust my the normalization so that I get something non-trivial in the limit. So I want to understand these fluctuations. And again, on the combinatorial level, this is quite well known. So you can do a genus expansion, which tells you essentially how you calculate exactly these quantities, and in particular, if n goes to infinity in a large n limit, you again get some very nice leading order, which has somehow the flavor of these non-grossing pairings as before, but now things are living not just on a line or on one circle, but on two circles. So the situation is here. So if you want to calculate this in a limit, so what you have to do, you should put, so you have two traces, huh? A trace of a product with the F1 up to Fn, and a trace corresponding to Fn plus 1 and Fn plus m. And you should put the elements of the first trace on one circle, the vectors corresponding to the other trace on the second circle, and again you should look for non-crossing pairings, but now you have pairings in this annular structure. Okay, so now you're looking for pairings which connect all these things, and these pictures, these lines shouldn't cross. So in the limit, again, you only get the non-crossing contributions. And I think Jamie talked yesterday exactly about these situations. I mean, in the Wishart case, where you have more complicated, you do not only have pairings, but you have all permutations. Okay, but this is exactly, this is the Gaussian case. Okay, so this should be the annular non-crossing ones, and in particular, what you also require is that you connect the two circles, because you take the difference of this expectation there. If you only take the expectation of the product of the traces, you would also get terms with pairings which don't connect, but you're subtracting them away in the second term. So this means that what you get here in the limit are exactly the annular non-crossing connected pairings between these two circles. Okay, so this is well understood limit behavior. It's very nice. And in particular, of course, it has very much the flavor of things which we have seen before. Okay, but up to now, I mean, this is something which we cannot really explain in the framework of free probability theory, because, I mean, it has nothing to do with the concepts which we usually have around. It looks very similar from a combinatorial point of view, but it's also different. So the question is, can we extend what we know from free probability theory, maybe a little bit more general, so that we can also realize this situation in some other context. So the main question is whether we can describe this limit also in terms of operators on a full Fock space, and whether we have some abstract Freeness-like concept behind this, which would somehow explain us what we have seen there in combinatorial terms. And the answer to both questions is yes, namely in the first case, with a realization on a Fock space, I want to show you that somehow you can describe this limit in terms of operators on the Fock space, but you have to invoke a kind of cyclic Fock space. And then maybe I will also shortly show you the answer to the second question, namely that there is some kind of freeness behind, but it's a freeness for tracial bilinear functionals. Okay, so I want to give you a little bit more details on this, but maybe the main slogan of this whole talk is that indeed we have a positive answer to both questions. And let me first talk about these Fock spaces, the cyclic Fock space. So in a sense, so we know that for realizing our limit of random matrices, we have to work on a full Fock space. But now, this corresponds to the situation where I have one trace. But now I have two traces, and as we have seen in the pictures, we should think we should think about our points being arranged on circles, not on a line. And the usual full Fox space has indeed this linear type of structure. Huh? So somehow it does not really fit with having the product of two traces. So if I'm thinking about the usual full Fox space, let's say the linear Fox space, then of course my elementary tensors, I'm thinking somehow as just having F1 tensor Fn, as just having the vectors F1 Fn as being arranged linearly on a line. And of course the inner product is just matching up these two lines and making the canonical connection. Huh? So I mean, the inner product in a full Fox space exactly goes with this idea that I have just strings of vectors which are paired in a canonical way. But now, in a sense, if I have these traces, it's much better. I have to think of my particles as being arranged on a circle, because I mean I have traces, which means I don't have a beginning and an end. So in the cyclic Fox space, I should, again, I have some elementary tensors, but I should think of them as being arranged on a circle. And this means, of course, if I'm taking now an inner product, I have two circles. Let's say one is sitting inside the other. And again, I have to pair up the corresponding vectors. But now, of course, I mean, because there's no beginning and no end, I have the freedom of rotating the circles against each other. So the canonical inner product for such a situation is that I pair the vectors on one circle with vectors on the other circle, but I have a freedom of rotation, so I have to sum over all possibilities for making these rotations. And of course, the number of vectors on the inner and the outer circle has to be the same, because otherwise I don't find a pairing, as in a full Fox space, where, of course, if I have different numbers of particles, the vectors are orthogonal. Okay, so that's what I mean with the cyclic Fox space. Yeah, it's a tensor power, but I have defined another. The inner product is defined differently. No. I mean the pairing must be. I mean it's just going here. This is the same number. No, so this is F1, G1 plus K up to Fn, Gn plus K. So this means you pair up F1 with G1, Fn up to Gn, but you allow rotations, which means you can make a cyclic rotation of one of the indices. So, but this means if F1 is paired with this one, F2 must be paired with the next one, and so on. Yeah, a bit. So, of course, I have the action of the cyclic group. So, okay, but the question is, okay, do you have more of this? I don't know. I mean, so maybe you can see. I mean, this is just definition of something. I mean, the question is whether cyclic cohomology has something to do with other the main theorems. I don't see it, but maybe if anybody sees something concrete there. Okay, so the point is, because we have this product of traces, we should somehow try to work on these cyclic Fox spaces. And maybe the first idea is that one should have operators acting on the cyclic Fox space for giving me the limit of the fluctuations of the random matrices. But somehow it seems to me, I mean, there are no operators on the cyclic Fox space which have anything to do with the random matrix picture. Or at least, I mean, I'm not able to find any nice operators there. But it turns out that somehow the situation is maybe indeed nicer from some point of view, namely that you are still working with the operators which you have on the linear Fox space, but in the end you are embedding things into the cyclic Fox space. In the same way as you might think of if you apply a trace, you make a product of things, you make it cyclic. So first you are on a linear Fox space, and only in the end you bend things together to act on a cyclic one. So this means what we need is an embedding or is a mapping from the linear Fox space to the cyclic Fox space, so that in the end we can map everything to the cyclic Fox space. So we need some kind of linear mapping, which is defined in the following way. So let us take the algebraic full Fox space of H. We map this to the cyclic one by the mapping C. Okay, the vacuum goes to the vacuum. And then this mapping, of course, it's not just the saying that if I have a string of things, I just bend it together. This is just this first term. But if I'm doing this, I should also remind that I'm really interested in the action of creation and annihilation operators. And in a sense, I should now also make possible that if things come together, they have the possibility to annihilate each other. Because I mean, I'm interested in creating and annihilating things, and in a sense, I should also have the possibility that the beginning and the end can annihilate each other. In a linear Fock space, they can't do this. So I must somehow put this possibility into the game by allowing it to happen if things come together. So this means if I have F1 and Fn in a linear Fock space and I bend it together, I just get these points on the circle, but I also add the possibility that F1 and Fn annihilate each other. So I just get this contraction here, which is the inner product between these two things, and I'm left with n minus 2 points on the circle. Okay, and after this, F2 might meet Fn minus 1, so I should also allow the possibility that they annihilate, so I should get a term where I have these two contractions, and I'm left with these things on the circle. Okay, so I mean, this can put this recursive definition. So somehow the idea is that if I bend my line together to a circle, I also allow annihilations where the beginning and the end of my circle meet. And it turns out that indeed this is the right thing, namely with these mappings we indeed have the analog of the theorem before, namely we can describe the fluctuations of our random matrices now also in terms of operators on the full Fock space by taking into account this mapping C. So the fluctuations, so again, we have on one side we have our Gaussian random matrices, on the other side we have our operators, and the operators are still the same. These are the operators on a linear full Fock space. So we have these quantities, and the statement is that the fluctuations of my random matrices in the limit are given by a quantity in terms of operators on the full Fock space mapped under this mapping C to the cyclic Fock space, which is of a very similar structure. I mean, here I'm just subtracting, let's say, the highest order term, which corresponds to this one, and the main contribution is this one. So you see, I'm taking the product of my operator in the linear Fock space, and when I'm taking here the trace, I'm taking here this mapping C, which one should think of as bending the line together to a circle, as the trace does. I mean, the trace is a product of things, or I have a product of operators. If I'm taking the trace, suddenly I'm starting to think of having a cyclic symmetry for this product. And here I'm doing the same. Up to here I'm in the linear Fock space, but suddenly I'm mapping this to the cyclic Fock space. And the main theorem is that indeed this limit of the fluctuations is given by this quantity. So this means that indeed the limit of our random matrices does not only see the leading order, does not only contain the information about the leading order of our random matrices, but the limit object even contains this fluctuation, which is a priori not clear. But just by doing calculations on the full Fock space side, this creation and annihilation operators, you can recover fluctuations of random matrices. And okay, let me show an example for this one. Okay, so maybe an example for this calculation where we have a trace. Okay, on the random matrix side, so I'm looking on the trace of a product of three things and a trace of one element, and we know what this should be because we have a combinatorial description. So we should put our three points on one circle, one point on another circle, and we should look for all pairings. And all pairings which are possible are non-crossing pairings. So they are exactly those three pairings. And if you do the calculation in this Fock space, you will recover the same result. So first you act with the creation and annihilation operators in a full Fock space. You get this one here, and then you apply your mapping C. And it's important to see that if you in a linear Fock space, you essentially get these two terms. Coming back to a multiple of one vector, but if you apply this mapping C, you now also allow a possible pairing between F1 and F3. So you have a much more symmetric situation here. Okay, and this means that in the end, you exactly get three contributions. Namely, these three circles. And you should be aware, I mean, this is the one which comes from this mapping C, and in a linear picture, this would be a crossing one. So if you would try to draw this picture on two lines, so if you would have a line where you have a 2 and a line with a line with this 1, 2, 3 and another line with this blue 1, then this would be a crossing pairing. But because you are now on the circle, I mean, you can go behind the inner circle, which means it's indeed a non-crossing one. Oh, and it's exactly the mapping C, which also gives this as a contribution. If you only would act with the operators on the full Fock space without going to the cyclic one, you would have no possibility for getting this. Well, somehow this must be produced by this mapping C. Good, okay, so this is an example, and somehow this shows you that indeed, sorry? I mean it's even unbounded operator, it was only defined on F of the algebraic. I have not really thought about the fine details of what it indeed is, so I don't really know. But all our calculations essentially are just for polynomials. Huh? So I mean there are no infinite sums involved. But of course one should sometimes think about these questions. Yeah, okay, so what I have shown you up to now is that in this question about fluctuations around this limit that we have removed at least one question mark. So namely we have seen that we can realize these fluctuations also as operators. And I have only shown it to you for the Gaussian case, but you can do the same for the Wishart case by the same kind of operators as you had it before for the leading order. So I have shown you here that you can describe the limit of these fluctuations, or you can realize this limit by, again, it's the sum of creation and annihilation operator, but you have to map things to a cyclic Fock space. Okay, good. So, but still, of course, the question remains whether we have some abstract concept behind this. And I mean, of course, also the question remains how to prove this. I mean, this theorem is, I mean, we were not able to prove this just directly by writing it down, but in the end it turned out that we need some abstract concept behind this, because then, I mean, these abstract concepts on the first level show you that you get this distribution by central limit theorems. Okay, so in the same way, we proved this main theorem by also recognizing abstract concept behind this, which has some features of freeness and which allows you to recover this structure as some kind of central limit theorem. So this abstract concept is not, we needed it for doing the proof of this theorem. But I think it's indeed maybe the most important outcome of all this. So the question is, is there an abstract concept behind all these questions and the answers which have some feature of freeness? So maybe, let me see, what is the frame what we are having? So let's say we have underlying algebra, which is the star algebra, which is generated by our operators omega of F. And then, of course, we have the state, pi of A, the vacuum expectation state, which is the one which is important for the leading order. Okay, but now we have seen, if we want to talk about the fluctuations, it's essentially that we want to understand this quantity, which is now a bilinear function, kappa of A, B, which is evaluated in a cyclic Fock space. So C maps everything to the cyclic Fock space. But of course you can say I have this bilinear functional, which is defined on my algebra, and which has this property. And of course, important in our context is this traciality. It represents the fact that I have traces in each of its arguments. So this kappa is a trace in both arguments. So what I have here is exactly this as an abstract thing. And then the question, of course, which we have in such a frame, and which is, of course, the question about freeness, is so if we now say our Hilbert space is a direct sum of spaces H1 up to HR, and we consider the algebras generated by the operators belonging or corresponding to this space, then of course I have this AI sitting as sub-algebras in the big AH, and the question is, what can I say about the positions of them? Of course, with respect to something. I mean, freeness, original definition of freeness deals with respect to phi, but here my main quantity is this kappa. So the question is, what can I say about the position of this sub-algebra in my big algebra with respect to this kappa? Is there some nice description which is somehow similar to the one which I know for phi? Okay, indeed there is. And it turns out it's the following one. So namely, what should we do? Or what are we doing if we talk about freeness? Freeness, I mean, for freeness, I consider phi of alternating centered words in my subalgebra. So the definition of freeness goes like this. So you look on words which are coming alternatingly from some of the subalgebra. Each of them should be centered, and then you just know what phi on such a product is. Namely, it's very simple. It's zero. Okay, but anyhow, freeness gives you, tells you what phi of this thing is. And in the same philosophy, now we have a kappa of two arguments, so we should put such alternating cyclic things in each of the arguments, and somehow we should be able to say what kappa in this case is. So I have here a kappa of a1 up to an and a b1 of up to bm, and each of these tuples a1 up to an and b1 up to bm should be cyclically alternating. I mean, I'm in a cyclic frame, so I should also require that the first element is from a different algebra than the last one. Because kappa is cyclic, I mean, of course, I always can rotate it in such a way that I can achieve such a situation. So if I know these things, then I know everything. And I assume they are centered. And of course, they should be centered with respect to phi. I mean, centeredness with respect to kappa doesn't make much sense. Huh? So it means I also have to involve phi here. It's not just a statement about kappa, but it's a statement about the pair kappa and phi. Huh? So this means I'm calculating kappa in terms of some knowledge of kappa and some knowledge of phi. Phi is always involved. It enters essentially for centering these things. Okay, so and then if I have an analogy with freeness, I would expect that I can say something about the calculation of such words. In the free situation, it's very simple. Then the phi of alternating centered words is always zero. Here it is a bit more. I mean, A1 up to AN is a product, and B1 up to BM is also a product. Kappa has two arguments, but now each argument is a product of alternating centered words. Okay, and here's the statement, what it is. So, if N is different from M, then it is zero. And, I mean, the most interesting case is this one. So, again, I'm thinking about having A1 up to AN sitting on two circuits. And now I'm looking for pairings, which pairs me the A's with the B's, and the contribution of such a pairing is phi of the corresponding product. So it's exactly the same situation which I had for taking my inner product. So the statement is, in such a situation, kappa of such a product, I have to look for all matchings which match the A's with the B's, which means, of course, in particular, that N has to be equal to M. I mean, the other situations, I don't get anything non-trivial. Huh? That's the only non-trivial situation. So if I have as many A's as I have B's, then I should match the A's with the B's in the same way as I did for the inner product. But of course, I have this freedom of doing a rotation. Huh? Okay, so I have N different possibilities for this matching. I can match A1 with any of the B's, and then the rest is determined what has to be matched. And such a matching gives me a contribution phi of the product of these two variables here. Huh? So the pairing as for the inner product. Huh? I mean, of course, maybe I should have a star here somewhere. Okay, anyhow. So this pairing gives me exactly phi of the product of those things, and kappa calculates exactly in this way. Huh? And this is indeed seems to be the right concept. I mean, that's, of course, the situation which is there if we look on our operators in the full Fock space. I mean, you have to check, of course, that subalgebras behave in this way. But, I mean, this is quite simple to check. And in the same way as you check freeness for the creation and annihilation operators. Well, this is nothing deep. I mean, as soon as you know what you want to check, you just do it. Okay, so to check that indeed this situation is there in the full Fock space setting is more or less easy. Okay, but then it turns out that this indeed is also the right concept for allowing us to prove our main theorem. Because now, I mean, our main theorem is now something. So you have these Gaussian random variables, and there the point is that you always can think of having your operator as a sum of smaller operators which are free in some sense. So what you are really interested in is in something which is a central limit. Which means you're essentially interested in making a central limit theorem with respect to this concept of freeness. And it turns out that you can do this, and you get exactly the combinatorics which you need. Good, so I mean, I haven't you shown Okay, I don't want to go into details, but I hope I have convinced you somehow that indeed, even on this fluctuation point of view, we have somehow the full picture which we had before for the expectation for the highest level point of view. So namely, we do not only have a combinatorial description of the limit, but we can also describe this limit in terms of operators on a full Fock space, where we also have to invoke this cyclic Fock space. And maybe most importantly, we have an abstract concept behind these things, which is so that we can say that this limit situation can be seen as a central limit with respect to trivial bilinear functionals which have this special kind of behavior which we just considered. So in a sense, we have some kind of freeness for these bilinear functionals. Okay, so good. I hope I have given you somehow some impression of what we are aiming at, and I hope that you agree that maybe that also the fluctuations of random matrices are really something which genuinely belongs to free probability theory. It's really part of free probability theory. Okay, thanks. Thank you very much.